Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning the programme with something that hasn't actually happened yet. It is perhaps an unusual approach to news, but when the US elections are going to be held in 2 days, this is something that's not just going to shape the future of the world's most powerful country, but quite possibly the future of the world. And this election is gripping, not just because of that importance, but because of how close it seems to be between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. In a moment, we'll hear from the person who's just overseen the last survey for one of the major pollsters. We're going to try and check in first with our correspondents who are following the candidates, heading first to Michigan, where Kamala Harris has been urging Detroit churchgoers to cast their vote.
I see a nation determined to turn the page on hatred and division and chart a new way forward. As I travel, I see Americans from so-called red states to so-called blue states who are ready to bend the arc of history toward justice. I see an incredible number of our young people, our young leaders. Oh, it would inspire you to see how they are organizing for change. What I love about that generation, Bishop, they are quite impatient in a most wonderful way.
Well, Michigan had long been seen as a solidly Democratic state, at least for the presidential elections. But Donald Trump won it by a whisker back in 2016, and it looks very close this time round. And there is, of course, this time around, a twist in Michigan. Ione Wells is our correspondent there. And Ione, what is that twist?
Well, twist in Michigan, I'm not sure exactly which twist you're referring to.
Well,
actually,
in terms of the Arab American vote there. And I know that you've been speaking to many people who have very strong opinions about that.
That's right. This is the state which has the largest Arab American community in the US, particularly in some cities like Dearborn, which is the largest Arab majority city in the US. Now, of course, as you might imagine, as a result, there is a lot of anger in places like Dearborn about the Democrats and President Biden's administration's response to the war in the Middle East, for example. And I think as a result, there are a lot of people that I spoke to there who are considering either voting for Donald Trump or voting for a third candidate, somebody like the Green Party's Jill Stein, or even not voting at all. There are still some people who are voting for the Democrat, but say that it is pretty reluctant as a result of the Democrats' Middle East policy. I spoke, though, to one person, Dr. Hassan Abdel Salam, who gave a sermon at a Friday prayers in Dearborn, and he summarized, I think, some of that anger and mood among voters there.
Punish the vice president because of her genocide, and ensure that we take the blame for her defeat in order to buy power so that we'll never again be ignored. The number of people in this very hall could determine Michigan.
Do you feel like Donald Trump might punish your community in other ways, though?
The Republicans every day, just again recently, they're seeking our endorsement, coming, telling us that they have very different policies on Gaza.
As you heard there, that was Dr. Hassan Abdel Salam telling me why he believes he's not going to vote for the Democrats, and he believes that it is more important, in his words, to punish the vice president for the Democrats' policy on that issue. Now, in a very different part of Michigan, I'm here now in the hall in Lansing, where Kamala Harris is set to address a rally pretty shortly. This is a very solidly Democrat area, somewhere which I think she's pretty confident she's going to pick up a lot of votes. But as we heard there, some parts of Michigan are not as, as solid as they used to be. Both places like Dearborn, where there is that large Arab American community, but also places like Macomb County, which is a predominantly white working class area, a lot of blue collar workers there. Again, used to be a very Democrat area. It was a very unionized area, but in recent years it has shifted to Donald Trump, with him making a pitch there about some of his socially conservative values, his economic policies, which is why a lot of voters there have shifted to him in recent years.
Ione Wells, good to speak to you in Lansing, Michigan. Let's go from Michigan to the biggest swing state of them all, Pennsylvania, with its 19 electoral college votes. Donald Trump started his day there, speaking at an event in the small town of Lititz. Mr. Trump said the Biden and Harris administration had broken the economy and the U.S. immigration system.
I've come today with a message of hope for all Americans. With your vote on Tuesday, I will end inflation. I will stop the invasion of massive numbers of criminals coming into our country. Thank you very much, Kamala and Joe. And I will bring back the American dream, and we'll bring it back stronger than ever before. But this is all you need to know. Kamala broke it, and we will fix it. And we're going to fix it fast.
Donald Trump speaking earlier at that rally. Tom Bateman, our correspondent, was at that rally. Tom, that wasn't all he had to say, was it? He rarely just keeps himself to concise comments. But what was the other big takeaway for you from that rally?
Well, I mean, for the first 20 minutes or so, he really launched into his sort of diatribe, really, about the election itself. And he talked about the Democrats, he talked about people running the elections, he talked about the press, and saying that, in his words, crooked people out there were fighting hard to steal the election. He mentioned a few specifics in that area, namely about the fact that there has been mail-in votes, so that people have been able to vote in the run-up to election day of Tuesday, also the use of electronic counting machines, for example. But really, this was all a sort of very lengthy and repeated attempt to try and discredit the election process itself. And in front of a very, very large crowd in Pennsylvania, which is, of course, is a key swing state just 2 days before the election. He also referenced the fact that he'd gone off script and saying, you know, this isn't what's on the teleprompter. And when I do this, my officials tell me not to say it because the networks switch me off, and didn't name them, but obviously pointedly referenced Fox News in that. So, you know, we had I think what his opponents will say is this was largely sort of laying the groundwork for if there is a very close result and then an extended period of counting for how we might try and challenge that.
Understood. And actually, I was just going to come on to that. You mentioned extended period of counting. I mean, if things are as close in a place like Pennsylvania as the poll suggests they could be, we may well not get a result from Pennsylvania on, well, Tuesday night or Wednesday.
No, I don't think we will. I mean, the polls are absolutely neck and neck. I mean, the latest CBS poll had them on 49% each. The Washington Post's sort of average of polls puts Kamala Harris less than a percentage point ahead. So, you know, well within the margin of error and close to what would be an automatic recount if it comes in at half a percentage point or less between the two candidates. So there will be a very slow and deliberative count anyway, because the officials know just how close and contested all of this is. In 2020, the result or the projections by the US networks didn't come through for Pennsylvania till Saturday. Now, they think they might have things a bit faster this time because they've been practicing, they've invested more money into the count. But I think we're talking several days at least.
Tom Bateman in Pennsylvania, thanks ever so much. Let's head now to New York. That's where Ruth Igelnick is. She's the polling editor at the New York Times, and they have just published their final survey. Ruth, very good to have you on NewsHour. We try on the BBC not to go too heavily on one particular survey, but given that we've got you on, tell me what your big takeaway from your final survey is.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And I think you're absolutely right to not put too much into any single survey, including our own. We ourselves look at the average of polls. But what we did find in these final surveys of swing state polls is that it is remarkably close in this final stretch in these seven key states that will decide the election.
And
practically, a photo finish.
And this may sound like a strange question, but are you confident about that? I mean, because everybody, all the major polls have seemed to suggest that it is incredibly tight. How much confidence is there that it really is like that?
You know, this is a challenge with polling overall, and I think it's important for everybody to understand. Polling is great at measuring the attitudes of the public and understanding what they think about things, but to predict these remarkably, insanely close elections that we have these days in the United States, polling is imperfect at that. It's pretty good at telling us things are very close, but polling is not built to do these kind of remarkably close elections and tell us with precision exactly who's 1 point this way or 1 point that way. So I feel confident that it's giving us a good picture of a tight race. It feels challenging to know what that might actually mean for Election Day.
Yeah, but it's interesting to hear you say that, because that does suggest that there is a feeling that the mistakes that certainly were made in previous elections involving Donald Trump, which essentially was to do with undercounting his support, that has been corrected this time round.
We have put a lot of time and effort, the entire polling industry, into trying to correct for those errors. And, you know, we can only know when this finally the election happens, how that goes. But we have a lot of confidence that things are going well. We're picking up plenty of Trump support. We don't have this idea of people not telling us they're supporting Trump. People are very vocal about telling us that they're supporting Trump. So I think in that way, and in the ways we've corrected those errors, we're not that concerned.
In terms of the big issue or issues for people, I mean, I'm sure part of it is the character of the two main candidates. But again, are you picking up that for most people, the big ticket thing is the economy?
Yeah, the economy has been the single most important issue for voters this entire cycle, and it does continue to be. But it's interesting. We're seeing a rise in some of these other issues, like abortion, and particularly for women. We saw in our last polls that now that is the most important issue for women nationally. And in states like Wisconsin, abortion is now rivaling the economy as the most important issue. And then on the other side, some of these issues that have been strong for Donald Trump, like immigration, we're seeing in a state like Arizona, where we found Trump doing quite well, that immigration has risen to be among the most important issues tied with the economy. So it is still the economy, but some of these other issues are really creeping up and driving forces in the election at the end.
And Ruth, obviously, it's not just about the presidency. It's also about statewide elections. And it is also about the House and the Senate. Is there more clarity, more certainty about which way the House and the Senate, those races might go overall?
Yeah, we did ask about Senate races in this poll, and we found that in the states that we polled, Democrats were doing quite well in the Senate races in these kind of seven key states. Now, the challenge for Democrats is, in order to hold on to control of the Senate, they need some races that are outside of these seven key states where we have also polled, places like Montana and Nebraska. And Montana in particular, it's looking like the Democratic senator there might lose his seat. It's looking pretty tight, and it's looking good for the Republican. So while the Democrats are doing remarkably well in these Senate races that we polled recently, It is looking tenuous for the Democrats to hold on to the Senate.
Ruth Igelnick, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks ever so much for joining us. That was Ruth Igelnick, polling editor at the New York Times. More on the American election coming up in the second half of the program with James Kumarasamy. We're also going to be hearing about one of the great treasures of Persian art, which was brought back to Tehran as part of a swap.
The Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, is a mythological national epic written by the renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi at the turn of the 11th century. And this particular one is so important because it's a magnificent 1,200-page edition of it in Nasaliq script.
It's a fantastic story. You'll be able to hear it in 30 minutes. One headline story we'll be covering in 15 minutes. King Felipe of Spain says he understands the anger and frustration of the people in flood-ravaged Valencia. More heavy rain has been predicted overnight on Sunday. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks, and we've got a remarkable story to bring you out of South Africa now. The police arresting more than 500 illegal miners out of an abandoned mine shaft after they had forced them out, the police, basically by starving them, blocking supplies of food and water. And despite that, it's thought hundreds of miners are still deep underground. Kimon de Grief is a freelance journalist based in Cape Town who's written extensively on illegal gold mining in South Africa.
So today is a large number of people. It's not unprecedented. Just a few years ago, 500 illegal miners were forced out from the shafts as well. at various times, there can be many thousands of people underground just in one small mining area. And more or less wherever there's gold shafts and where there was a functioning gold industry, there are now large numbers of Zamazamas. Although in the past few years, there has been a bit more of a government push to get them out of there.
You use the compound noun Zamazama. Just explain what that is.
It's a Zulu derivation of take a chance. So you take a chance, you go look for gold.
Right.
It's become a sort of shorthand for illegal mining of all types.
These miners were looking for gold, but in an abandoned shaft. So it's, I mean, you'd think that it's abandoned because there's not much down there.
Well, it kind of depends. So from the perspective of a company who has to run health and safety, ventilation, cabling, the costs are much higher, and so the yield needs to be much higher. When that becomes sub-economic for a large corporation, there's still huge quantities of gold in the ground that are appealing for people of a certain desperate bent, I suppose, to get out, and more importantly, can be done economically because these guys are working with very rudimentary equipment,
right,
with no health and safety. These are no longer ventilated shafts, collapsed in many areas. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of miles of tunnel reaching down vertically 2 kilometers or further. To get in and out is incredibly expensive because the tunnels are controlled by incredibly violent illegal mining syndicates. And there's a risk of detection from whatever security might happen to be around. And so generally people go down and they stay down, and sometimes stay down for a year or more.
If it's such a big operation, and you're saying that, you know, criminal networks are involved as well in this, in a sense, how is it allowed to function? Because presumably it's a big operation. Is there a sense that there's sort of official collusion in this?
The economy generates an enormous amount of money. By some estimates, illegally mined gold makes up 10 to 20% of all the gold still mined in South Africa, which is much less gold than was mined in the past, but still a huge amount of gold. And gold is worth more per ounce now than it ever has been. So the money that generates, a significant portion of it, I would say, does go into corrupting people throughout the value chain and in law enforcement. And then add in that there's a huge labor pool of people willing to do this work and sometimes coerced into doing this work, because there is a kind of human trafficking angle to the Zamazama underground mining phenomenon as well.
You say human trafficking. Are a lot of these mine workers from abroad?
Generally speaking, most of the people who are arrested, whenever arrests happen, are from Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Lesotho. And that's driven a whole kind of xenophobic pushback against illegal mining in South Africa, which is politically quite valent at the moment. At the same time, these miners contribute massively to the local economies wherever they are, because there's enormous amounts of food that need to get smuggled underground to feed them. And they spend their money when they come up. One of the most interesting conversations I had was with the head of the Chamber of Commerce in one of the mining towns that has become a Zamazama hotspot, or I think she had recently quit. She was very frank with me about, without this illicit economy, there would be no economy in town.
Is there any controversy in South Africa about the use of these pretty savage tactics of trying to starve people out?
Many South Africans are probably approving of it, in the sense that they see this illegal mining as a national scourge and they want our government to be clamping down on it. I don't share that view, and I think that if 500 are coming out of the tunnels, the odds are that a few have already died down there. And the deaths that happen in this underworld are mostly unrecorded and uncounted, but number in the thousands.
That was the Cape Town-based journalist Kimon de Greve. Wedged in the Himalayas between China and India, the tiny nation of Bhutan was, until the 1970s, largely cut off from the outside world. It's perhaps best known for measuring its development in terms of gross national happiness. But Bhutan also has a unique musical tradition called Dzongdra, with songs in an ancient language used by Buddhist monks. The producer Ian Brennan has been to Bhutan and recorded an album by a group called the Bhutan Balladeers. He spoke to the BBC's Martin Venard at this year's World Music Festival WOMAD, along with King San Choden from the group, who began by explaining what their songs are about.
There is singing the song which is related to the temple, is related to the spiritual person, to our king and the people. And we are also expressing our gratitude towards the country.
And Ian, how did you come across these musicians?
We went to Bhutan specifically to meet musicians and singers. And Bhutan is called the least visited place on earth. They've tried to limit tourism, so it's very expensive to go there. And we were so lucky to meet the collective, and we recorded 17 singers and 3 hours of music in the forest by the world's largest sitting Buddha, which is 169 feet high, at the top of a mountain that was, we could see the back of its head the entire time we were recording.
And what was it that stood out about the music and the instruments to you?
Well, I think that there's a directness and a relationship to the land itself, and many of the songs are about the land. The Horse is Our Friend is one of the songs. But also that the singing is seemingly simple but incredibly complex. And they're singing in a language that is essentially a foreign language within their own country. It's the language of religion. It's like Latin to Europe or Ge'ez in Ethiopia.
Their instruments is a wooden flute, a lute, and a two-stringed violin or fiddle. What is it that's notable about those to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because just when they were playing here live at WOMAD, the sound man is a cello player, it turns out, and he was really taken with this. And he said how powerful it was to him, how much it resonated with him as a cello player to hear, you know, this double-string lute being played, and how much it impacts you very emotionally. And so I think there's a resonance there in the voices as well. I mean, a lot of the record is a cappella, solo voices, duos.
So you have a national index of happiness in Bhutan. How happy does the music make you feel?
Music is everything to me. The music makes me happy. The music changed my mood.
A happy ending.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely enchanting music of Bhutan. That was Martin Venard reporting on the Bhutan Balladeers. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Welcome back to NewsHour. We led with the US election. We've got one on a much smaller scale to tell you about now, but it is one which promises to have an impact beyond its borders. It's the runoff in the former Soviet Republic of Moldova between the current president, Maia Sandu, who wants much closer ties with Europe, and Alexander Stoyanoglu, who's backed by the more pro-Russian Socialist Party. The first round of elections was held 2 weeks ago. According to the authorities in Moldova, it was a vote marred by a huge vote-buying scheme orchestrated out of Moscow. Paola Erizanu is a journalist based in the capital, Chisinau. Paola, I was just seeing just before we came to you, the agencies are saying 93% of the votes have been counted. It's looking very close, isn't it?
It is looking very close, but the vote is tipping in favor of incumbent Maia Sandu now. And it's likely that she will win a kind of more solid vote once the diaspora votes are being counted. The Moldovan diaspora is traditionally very pro-European, and so it's quite likely that Maia Sandu will win another round. There was a lot of celebration at her staff headquarters, whereas the Socialist Party announced that they will have no more briefings tonight. So they have somehow kind of assumed their loss in this election.
And I don't want to get too bogged down in the technicalities, but given that they, you say they've yet to tally the votes in the diaspora, how long is that likely to take?
Well, by tomorrow morning, we will know the precise final results.
Okay. Just in terms of how this vote has gone, even if it is moving towards Maya Sandu, am I right in saying that there has still been concerns about interference from outside?
Yes, there have been lots of proofs that there was vote buying on behalf of Russia's networks. There were planes that Russia organized for Moldovans in Russia to use for free in order to vote in other polling stations in Istanbul, for instance, or in Baku. And we have seen independent observers comment on these breaches and also journalists report on them. But it looks like the record turnout has meant that the votes were mightier than the cheating that Russia used in order to try and distort the election results.
Paola, thank you very much. Well, we'll keep an eye on those results. I dare say our edition of NewsHour that goes out earlier in the day on Monday will be across that. But Paola Erizanu, a journalist based in the capital of Moldova, Chisinau, thank you very much for joining us. This is the BBC World Service, and live from London, you're listening to NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Fury and fear in southeastern Spain. Fear because of another red alert issued for parts of southern Valencia. In other words, another official warning of a threat to life with extremely intense rainfall forecast after the floods of last week killed more than 200. Fury. Well, that was made manifest when the King and Queen came to visit today. They came to offer support. They were met with hundreds of outraged protesters flinging mud and flinging insults. Our correspondent Mark Lone was there in the small town of Paiporta.
Paiporta, ground zero of the carnage. More than 60 people died here when the mud and water enveloped the Valencian suburb, devastating it. Into the heart of darkness today came Spain's King and Queen, Prime Minister and the regional president accused of failing to warn of the floods in advance and of a desperately slow response. Asesino! Asesino! The chant, murderer. The anger grows. A protester attacks our camera. And then they hurl what they can find from the torrents below.
This is just unprecedented. I mean, people are picking up mud, throwing it at the king. The depth of anger here, the fury, is just extraordinary to see.
King Felipe comforts some and is then led away, shielded from the crowd. His wife's face bearing a residue of mud. We're just 16, he says. We are helping and the leaders do nothing. People are still dying. I can't stand this anymore. I have no strength left. They left us to die, she tells me. When we needed them, they weren't here. We've lost everything. Our businesses, our homes, our dreams. And others have lost family, like Rafa, who owned a print shop with his two brothers, now a wreck. As the waters rose, his brother Tony stayed inside to take refuge. Tony's body was found a street away, his three sons now without a father.
We are outraged. This is a great country, but with disgusting, incompetent leaders. I'm so angry I can't talk anymore. I don't have the strength to speak about my brother. He was a really good person. I have no more words. I'm sorry.
It is, frankly, hard to take in the apocalyptic scale of this destruction. to get Paiporta alone back on its feet. The homeless rehoused in shelter, damage reimbursed, could take months. But then repeat that for mile after mile of this stricken region.
Spain, stunned, traumatized, and where rage is tipping over, only eased by the solidarity of the people. Today, the spark was ignited here. But as the number of dead rises further and the depth of loss becomes deeper, this country is at a delicate moment.
Mark Lowen reporting from Paiporta. And just to underline that sense of a country facing a major moment in its recent history, late this evening, local time, King Felipe put out this statement on video hours after he'd been forced to cut short that visit to Paiporta.
These people need hope. We need to address the emergency, but also to give them hope and ensure that the full presence of the state is there for them. Every day will get better, I believe. This isn't speculation. I think the resources are increasing, and so is effectiveness. We need to understand the anger and frustration of many people because of the hardship they've endured and the difficulty in understanding how all the mechanisms and emergency response operations work.
The King, late this evening, Spanish time. Robin Sapina has been one of the small army of volunteers working in Paiporta. He's an aerospace engineer who happens to live close by.
Paiporta has been completely devastated. The floods made the water go up enough for every single car in the city to get moved, shattered against walls or against other cars. Every single street in the city is completely full of mud. Garbage, a lot of debris everywhere. Some bridges have collapsed. Some other bridges are still up, but they're definitely in a very, very bad state. And right now, in the past few days, you have thousands and thousands of people just trying to clean up all the debris and trying to get mud out of the houses and the ground floors and the different places that have been severely affected.
Yeah, so. And you're one of those thousands. Have you been aware of much of an official response? We heard at the start of today that thousands more military were going to be deployed to the region to try and help with recovery and the cleanup. Are you seeing much evidence of that?
Truth is, yes, we are. We do see a lot of military going around. We've seen police since day one, a lot of helicopters, a lot of vehicles. But the truth is, from what we know, they are helping to get water out of the different parking lots and garages. They've been trying to find survivors or, you know, of course, people who have been missing, possibly dead, of course. They've been doing that since day one. That has been their first priority. So it's true that people have not seen them yet helping out a lot with their houses or helping out a lot with the food supplies, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people have been actually bringing a lot of food and water from the main city, from Valencia. Of course, there's more volunteers than military and police, so it kind of does feel like the people and the nearby cities are doing more effort than the state.
And do you think that is what underlay the extraordinary display of anger today when the King and the Queen and the Prime Minister turned up?
Yes, I think it's a mix of three different things. The first one is that, well, when the floods happened, it's true that the national alert came too late. We even believe that some people may have already been dead when the alert came. So that was one of the main triggers at the very beginning of why did no one tell us that this was going to be so severe. That's true. We were in red alert for raining, but in the end, no one was expecting this kind of situation, and a lot of anger comes from that. Secondly, it's true that a lot of people feel like the military and the politicians have not been sending enough help. Like, for example, the military came in 3 days after the disaster, I believe. That's how it went. And people feel like that was too late. Like, people feel like the military should have been here on day one from the very beginning. But since the politicians actually have to coordinate between themselves and the parties that are governing in the city and in the whole state and the country are different, it seems like those differences between parties have made things slower. And a lot of people are very angry at that situation. And the last thing, which I believe is the final trigger, is the fact that we haven't seen an official visit from presidents and, you know, King and Queen, etc., until day five. So a lot of people in the village keep asking, why are they here? Why did they even come 5 days after?
And the ordeal may not be over, because just late this evening we've heard that there is a further red alert. I think probably further south from where you are, but the rain is back, isn't it?
It is. It is. Right now it's raining heavily. It's been raining for like an hour and a half now. And I think it's going to stay like this until, I think, 11 p.m. So, yeah, definitely the situation is not the best that we could have right now.
Yeah, but and it's just going to make the cleanup all the more challenging for you and everybody else, isn't it?
Yes, that is very, very correct. Plus, there's a lot of food and supplies have been delivered. So I just hope, you know, everything's safe under a roof.
Robin Sabina speaking to me from Torrent, close to Paiporta in Spain. Back to our main story, Tuesday's election in the US. One state which is definitely seen as a swing state, one that either candidate could grab, according to the polls, is Wisconsin in the Midwest. Former President Barack Obama has just finished speaking at an event in Milwaukee.
For those of you who are still making up your minds out there, do not give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt because he was on a reality show. And certainly do not give him credit for an economy that he inherited. There is only one candidate who has offered serious ideas about how to drive down prices and make this economy work for everybody, and that is Kamala Harris.
Well, my NewsHour colleague James Kumarasamy was also at that rally, and I spoke to him just before we came on air as the former president came off the stage. How had he tried to close the deal for Kamala Harris?
As we talk, the crowds are pouring away through this center. They've just spent about an hour or so listening to the former president, and he gave a pretty forceful message, which was to say Donald Trump may be someone who talks a good talk, but he doesn't have the concept of a plan when it comes to the economy, when it comes to immigration, when it comes to all the things that he talks about. He contrasted him with Kamala Harris. And this is the old Obama, a grayer Obama, but still in shirt sleeves. I covered his election campaign in 2008 from start to finish, and he liked to bring back the old rhetoric, fired up and ready to go. No hope and change this time. It was all about voting. There's a big sign up that says, when we vote, we win. But yes, it was interesting. He talked a lot more, I would say, about Donald Trump than he talked about Kamala Harris. He said she has always fought for you, but he was at pains really to contrast her with Donald Trump on attitude, on competency, and specifically on whether or not she thought more about herself than about the American people.
I know, Jamie, that you've been speaking to people in Wisconsin who are really struggling at the moment because of prices and ever more reliant on things like food welfare. A lot of the country feels the country is going in the wrong direction. How bigger an obstacle is that for the Democrats to get over in a place like Wisconsin?
It's clearly a very big obstacle. Yes, you know, Barack Obama mentioned this a few times. He said, I understand if you are thinking about voting for Donald Trump because at the moment you are hurting, despite the fact that the economy is doing well. He talked about that disconnect. And yes, a lot of people we've spoken to here feel there is a disconnect between the big, broad GDP figures that talk about a healthy economy and what they are feeling. They are feeling it's tough to make ends meet. They are seeing prices are still high and rising, even if they're rising slower than they have done over previous years. But I think, yes, that is the big hurdle that Kamala Harris has to overcome. Barack Obama is saying, look, politics, presidents can't do everything. They can't help everything. But, and he kept bringing it back to character. He kept bringing it back to a need for unity. He referenced his speech 20 years ago when he first appeared on the stage in America, when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention and talked, remember, about there not being red states and blue states, but the United States of America. And he said, look, people have said to him they are naive. That's a naive statement given the way the country's gone. And he said, no, it can come back together. But those pocketbook issues are the ones that a lot of Americans are going to be voting on here. And this was very much a get out the vote campaign. He was here in Milwaukee because this is one of the cities which are very, very Democratic in the center. And he wants to get as many Democrats out to vote.
And that was NewsHour's James Kamara-Salmi in Wisconsin. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. And we're going to finish by looking back at one of the most remarkable art deals of recent times. It happened 30 years ago, and I have to say, before I came to this interview, I had absolutely no idea about it. It was an exchange brokered by the British Islamic art dealer Oliver Hoare, more than 100 pages of perhaps the greatest edition of perhaps the greatest work of classical Persian literature, the Book of Kings or Shahnameh, held by a collector in the US. They were swapped for a painting by the 20th century Dutch-American artist Willem de Kooning in the collection of the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. Oliver Hoare died some years ago, but his posthumous memoir of the exchange has just been published. We'll hear more about that in a moment. But first, a flavour of the opening lines from the tens of thousands of couplets that comprise the Shahnameh.
بنام خداوند جان و خرد که از این برتر اندیشه بر نگذرد خداوند نام و خداوند جای خداوند روزیده رهنمای.
That extract from the Book of Kings from a BBC documentary of a few years ago. Roxanne Zand knew Oliver Hoare well, the art dealer behind this swap. She's is also a writer and curator and former deputy chairman for the Middle East at the auctioneers Sotheby's.
The Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, as the literal translation of what that word means, is a mythological national epic written by the renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi at the turn of the 11th century. And this particular one is so important because it's a magnificent 1,200-page edition of it in Nasaliq script. And it was commissioned during the Safavid era in the early 1500s. And it came to be known as the Shah Tahmasp Shahnameh. To this day, it's considered the grandest, most beautifully illustrated, monumental Shahnameh ever to be produced. The Shahnameh itself was created over a span of two decades. That's more than 500 years ago in a studio of 15 painters. And it has 258 illuminated miniatures and 750 text folios, which were meant to accompany each miniature. And I have to say that its place in Iran's national heritage can't be overstated. Ferdowsi is to Iranians what Shakespeare is to the Anglophone world.
How did it end up abroad?
Flashback to 1658, when Shah Tahmasp gifted the Shahnameh to the Ottoman ruler Sultan Selim II, who kept the book at the Topkapi until 1903, when it resurfaced at the Exposition des Arts Musulmans in Paris in the possession of Baron Edmond de Rothschild. Then half a century later, the Nazis stole the work from the Rothschilds and took it to Bavaria, where it stayed until the end of World War II. And it was finally returned to the son of Edmond Maurice as part of post-war restitution. Then Maurice attempted to sell the work to the Metropolitan Museum of Art for a price of $400,000, but the museum declined. And after his death, a Harvard professor and Islamic scholar persuaded a wealthy industrialist, Arthur Houghton Jr., to buy the work in 1959 for $350,000. In the 1960s, the folios were unbound, and this is really the historical moment of crime, so to speak. Originally, they were unbound for producing facsimiles, but this proved really fatal because it was never rebound. In 1970, Houghton took out 78 folios valued at $1 million each to gift to the Met on the occasion of its anniversary, but the IRS questioned this value and asked for proof. So Houghton auctioned seven folios in 1976 through Christie's that brought over $1 million. Over the following years, the remaining further folios were stored at Lloyds Bank and were gradually sold until only 118 remained.
It sounds almost like you were sort of carving up the Sistine Chapel and sort of handing chunks of Michelangelo's masterpiece around the world. So tell me how it got to the point where more than 100 of these folios were exchanged with what is seen as a masterpiece of contemporary Western art, but not a masterpiece on the scale of this Persian treasure.
So in order to answer your question, I have to go to 1977, just shortly before the Islamic Revolution, when the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art opened its doors to essentially a largely uninitiated Iranian public who nevertheless appreciated the notion of hosting what's now become known as the finest and largest collection of Western art outside of the West. So there were many high-quality works by Impressionist and modern European masters, such as Picasso, Derain, Pollock, Bacon, de Kooning. And around this time, the Houghton family were determined to sell their Shahnameh folios for profit. So at that time, 28 folios were offered to Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi of Iran for $28.5 million, but this was declined. So over a decade later, Arthur's son, Arthur Houghton III, approached Oliver Hoare, a well-known Islamic art dealer. There were holdups, secret impromptu calls, and this culminated in the historical exchange that we're talking about on the tarmac of the Vienna airport on July 28, 1994.
Why were the Houghtons so keen on the de Kooning?
It would seem elements of the de Kooning were considered inappropriate and offensive by the Iranian Selection Committee.
So in terms of the Shahnameh and these folios that you said were exchanged, what's happened to them?
They remain in the basement of the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art, which in a sense, I suppose, makes sense for conservation reasons. Paper is very fragile.
Mm.
The best that one can get to it are these initiatives to create facsimile editions. The Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art has done the 2014 edition.
I mean, it's an amazing story, this exchange, but actually it's a heartrending story because here is something that is so important to the cultural heritage of a country, which remains dispersed and therefore, in a way, lost.
I think all the folios being restored and brought together is definitely a pipe dream. It's unrealistic to think that. And obviously, I'm sure you're aware that other important works have been dismembered as well, except that the Shahnameh was one of the most glorious and the crime was one of the highest order. But to bring them together is very unrealistic. However, having had some folios restored back to Iran, in my personal and humble opinion, was an appropriate thing to have happened. 118 folios are now back in their homeland.
It is an amazing story, really. Roxanne Zand, friend of the late Oliver Hoare, who's posthumously published memoir about that swap involving the Book of Kings, has just come out. I want to give you an update from Moldova, from the runoff election that is being held there between the pro-EU incumbent president and the rather more pro-Russian opponent that she's been facing, Alexander Stoyanoglu. I'm looking at the website from the Central Election Commission of Moldova. 95.31% of the votes counted. And at the moment, Maia Sandu is pulling out to almost 52% of the vote, with, as I say, 95% of the votes counted. From all of us here on NewsHour, thanks very much for your company.